From WXXI News, it's 1370 Connection. I'm Bob Smith. I'm going to ask you right now to rewind back about 65 or 70 years. Rochester on the eve of World War II would look a lot to you like a 19th century city with very few tall office towers and few 20th century buildings of any kind. A city that maybe your great-great-grandfather would have found familiar. Well, the last seven decades have seen a lot of change in the center of the city, for sure, with even more changes that were planned and dreamed but never came to be. It's the plans for Rochester that went unfulfilled that can be just as interesting and important as the ones that came to pass. We're going to talk about both this hour, as Daniel J. Palmer has written an illustrated history of the plans and projects that were once destined for downtown, some of which happened, some of which we see every day as we come into town to work, and some of which never got off the drawing board. The book is Rochester's Downtown Architecture, 1950 to 1975. Its official publication to date happens to be today. Daniel Palmer chairs the Landmark Society's Committee on the Restoration of the Recent Past and the Resources of the Recent Past, and he's joining me right now. Daniel, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Now, I characterized Rochester at the dawn of the modern era as very much a 19th century city in its look and feel. Would you say that's a pretty good characterization of what it was, with only a few isolated exceptions?
Up until the World War II era and the post-World War II era, Rochester, pretty much looked like it had throughout the 1890s, or the 1800s, actually. The era of the Powers Building, the Wilder Building, the Elwood Building. And, you know, the guys coming back from the war, the city was pretty much the way they left it and the way it had been for, I'd say, almost 100 years. And then after that, it changed in large ways and, you know, it's continuing to change today.
And in some ways, we were kind of behind the curve in a way, because when you think of right down the road in Buffalo, there was a lot of building. There was a lot of cracking of a skyline during the first third of the first half of the 20th century. They built a lot of new buildings, a new city hall. There were other office towers like the Rand Building and the rest that went up in Buffalo. We never got that, even though we were just as prosperous a city and just as industrious and busy a city as Buffalo was. Buffalo changed its skyline an awful lot during the first half of the 20th century. We didn't. I've often wondered why and if we can find any inkling in the photographic record, in the records of the time, to show why we were behind the curve back then at the end of World War II.
Well, I don't know if it's so much being behind the curve as you had mentioned earlier before we got on the air that the metropolitan areas were about the same size, Buffalo and Rochester.
Now.
But back then, you know, speaking of city proper, which is really where all this development was centered, Buffalo had about 600,000 people. And Rochester had about 300,000 people, so we were half the size of Buffalo, and I think just therefore the development was smaller scale and you know, there was less of it.
There just wasn't as much happening here.
Right. You know, you need the people and the money, I think, to do it.
Well, of course, the skyline looks very, very different today, which is, of course, good news in the sense that a lot of things did happen here. Maybe in some respects the face of Rochester changed more than any other upstate city, with the arguable exception of Albany. But by the same token, not everything that we were planning actually happened. And that's one thing I want to talk about a lot today, because you've found the photographic record of a lot of things that were supposed to be, a lot of things that came to pass and how they went through changes over time, and a lot of things that didn't happen. We'll talk a lot about those. One thing that jumps to mind, one of the first public projects of the post-war era, the War Memorial, now known as Blue Cross Arena. I gather it was originally, and the illustrations seem to show it, or suggest it at least, supposed to be a much bigger building than it turned out to be.
The original rendering that's in the book from, I believe, 1945, it's a much larger looking on the outside. I didn't come across any of the information that you gave me earlier about that it was supposed to be about 15,000 people. But the drawing itself, it looks like a much larger, modern, almost Art Deco building. And over time, because of economics and fundraising issues, and I think there was some conflict between the city and you know, other organizations or other entities, the scope of the project was reduced and the budget for it. So, you know, we ended up getting a somewhat more stripped down and smaller building.
I was thinking of that in light of the fact that that was around the time that the National Basketball Association was forming. Rochester had a franchise in it. And I often thought to myself, and I know my dad told me this a lot, he insisted, if we'd built the War Memorial the way it was supposed to be built, we'd still have the Royals. They wouldn't be the Sacramento Kings. Could he be right?
Possibly. I'm not really able to comment in depth on that, but I think what happened is the right after the war, you saw cities in the South and the West grow, and you saw the cities in the Northeast start to shrink, and the money is where, you know, the teams are going to go. So they went to, like, Sacramento and, you know, eventually places like Charlotte, which are new towns. And cities like Rochester and Syracuse, where I'm from, had the Nationals, and they left too. And I just think it's a matter of the population didn't continue to grow, and the economic situation in the city, you know, after the war ended was great for a while, but then manufacturing started to leave, and so did people.
I know as well that an alleged deal between the Boston Celtics and the Rochester Royals that ended up with Bill Russell going to the Celtics may have had something to do with it, too. That's old history, of course, and the what-ifs are interesting. The Royals would have had the right to draft Russell, and, of course, history would have changed in all of the NBA had they done so, but that's another story entirely. Rochester, by that time, had only a 7,500-seat hall in which to play, versus the Boston Gardens, which had twice as many people that it could put in at any night of the week. So you got to believe that there was no contest there, was there?
No, not at all. And Boston's a much larger, you know, financially important city, so to speak, and it still is today. You know, it's one of the great cities of America.
Exactly. And it makes you think what might have been. Of course, the Royals, as it was, even in the new arena, they only played there for that 1 year. Because, as you mentioned, 1945 was when they started talking about the War Memorial. It didn't open until 1956. And you got to wonder, is there anything in the record that really shows just what took it so long to go from start to finish? And why does that become, it seems, a recurring theme in Rochester that people talk about a project and it takes forever for it to come to fruition?
Mostly it was money. There was a fundraising drive back in 45 that raised about $1.5 million for the project. And I don't have the exact details here, but from my research, there was just a lot of back and forth with, you know, the different entities in charge of the development of it. And the costs went up like almost any project does, that if you look through the books or if you just pay attention to anything, the buildings usually go up after they're supposed to be done, and they usually cost more than they're supposed to cost. And as time went by, the cost of the building went up to about $5 million, I believe. It went from $2.5 to $4 million from 1945 to the 1950s when they really started to get serious about it. So, I mean, that was the main factor, was the money.
And they ended up with half the seating capacity they thought where they were going to get. Yeah, that becomes a recurring theme in Rochester. I guess we'll talk about that a lot more later on in the hour. And incidentally, your thoughts very much invited as well at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Daniel J. Palmer is the author of Rochester's Downtown Architecture, 1950 to 1975. In a way, a snapshot of what was and what might have been, how Rochester changed and how it might have changed over the period since World War II. You're invited to chip in your thoughts as well. 263-WXXI, 263-9994, or write into us in-studio email, asktalk@wxxi.org, which we'll be getting to in just a moment. There is one other sidebar to the War Memorial, and we'll get maybe to the Blue Cross Arena iteration of it a little later on, fast forward into the 21st century, but even before we do that, though, it was supposed to be part of something bigger. It was envisioned, I guess, as part of an overall civic center, a lot of which got built, the bigger civic center, but not exactly in the way that people had been talking about it for, I guess, decades. And they were talking, I gather, at one point, well before World War II, about a whole plaza of public buildings topped by a high-rise city hall. What happened with that, and why didn't that ever happen? Well, what would we have looked like as a city if we had built something like that, a tall, high-rise skyscraper city hall like the ones that Buffalo and Los Angeles got?
Well, we would have looked a lot more like Washington, D.C., but maybe on a smaller scale, or Philadelphia. those cities went along with the City Beautiful movement that occurred in the late 1800s that was influenced by the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago, where they showed areas with broad boulevards, monumental architecture, in some ways, you know, trying to capture the look of a more dense city like Paris or London even, where the buildings are built up to the street and there's, you know, in the middle there's a centerpiece building. The interesting thing about that plan is that, you know, we talk today a lot about how much it's important to see the river, have access to the river. And the more ambitious plan would have built a very wide boulevard over the river from Broad Street to Central. And it would have been something to see. You know, to imagine Rochester today like that, you really have to close your eyes and think about it. But I think ultimately, just like with everything else, conflicting interests and, you know, economics are almost always what defeat these plans. So in a way, we got part of it when they built the Rundell Library on the eastern side of the river between Broad and Court, and then the War Memorial was built on the western bank of the river, basically where they originally planned to be in this the Gordon and Kelber plan from the 1920s. The only thing missing really there is the city hall that was going to straddle the river and, you know, be a high-rise city hall. That never happened. And instead, the Civic Center was built across Exchange Street.
Well, of course, interesting to imagine how the city might have looked when they had, when Bruner and Frederick Law Olmsted got together for this huge central square, boulevards, radial streets leading toward a very tall city hall, looking like, again, first kind of a Romanesque, I guess, sort of tower, looking something like the Woolworth Building in New York in Lower Manhattan. And then you start fast-forwarding in the 20s to the Kelber drawing, and then in the 1930s, I guess, there was another plan. In the early 1930s, there was even more Art Deco and even more looking like the Los Angeles City Hall.
Yeah.
You look at these things, and you see a city that would have been radically different in its configuration. Either straddling the river or right adjacent to the river would be this big, tall municipal building, massive building, for a city that obviously had ambition to be just as big or as grand, at least, as Buffalo was at its height. If we built that, how would the whole city have changed? Would it have shifted the whole center of gravity for urban development around it?
Well, a lot of the modern projects that we do see downtown today wouldn't have been built because a lot of the area for that very ambitious plan for the city hall, and there's also I believe, a post office and the train station at the other end of that grand boulevard, that's pretty much the Genesee Crossroads area, and also, you know, the Civic Center War Memorial area. So they never would have happened, and we would have had those grand visions from the early 1900s instead.
So take out probably First Federal Plaza, take out Four Corners Building, take out Crossroads Office Building, take out just about everything in that whole big area on the west side of downtown, and try to replace it in your imagination with something like this. You got a very different city.
Oh yeah, definitely. Rochester, just like I think many other cities, just had a lot of ambitious plans and you know, big dreamers, and some of them got pretty far into development and then just didn't happen. And some of them, like the Civic Center that we have currently, were almost completed, but you know, are still awaiting completion of the original plan. Speaking of towers, there was a fascination with City Hall towers, because even in the 1950s plan, we have another City Hall, City County Tower straddling Exchange Street instead of the river.
That would have been, of course, a plan that would have brought the city and the county offices into one single building. The implications of that for the possibility of metropolitanizing local government is something else entirely. Can we pretty much figure out that died around the time that the city and the county ended up in the hands of different political parties? Because remember, back in the 1950s, everything was Republican, city and county alike. And if that had stayed that way after 1961, can we say that City Hall County Office Tower might very well have been built?
It might have. The big issue with that tower was finances, was who was responsible for paying for what. And so, you know, it might have to do with the change in the change in leadership, and, you know, it's less, maybe they're not able to get together. But the interesting thing is they tried to get that tower built up until, I have an article right here in front of me from the DNC from April of 1973, where they're once again proposing a new tower it's a different design than the original, but once again a high-rise city-county tower straddling Exchange Street. So,
and the Republicans were once again in control of the city between 69 and 73, so there you go.
Oh, well, there you go, and they
lost,
tried again.
And they lost the 73 election to the Democrats. Of course, the Democrats have controlled City Hall ever since. So the moment, I guess fair to say, that Steve May lost the election and gave way to Tom Ryan as mayor, that was the end of the tower?
Could be. Unfortunately, from being born in 1973 and having grown up in Syracuse, I missed a lot of the drama as it happened. So a lot of the record doesn't really reflect so much those types of political controversies. But
well,
I'm
you
sure
grew up
that
in
that
the Alexander years, so there was plenty enough
exactly,
drama there.
Yeah, I grew up in the Alexander city. But, you know, politics aside, the Civic Center as it is, it, to me, is incomplete. And it's, you know, it didn't exactly turn out the way they wanted it to. However, if they had built the tower and completed the promenade to the riverside that was supposed to be there and connected to the War Memorial Plaza, we would have lost the Casket Company building that we still have today. But I think that what we would have gained is a complete project that today would be a model of modern architecture for people to look at and see. And instead, we've got something that most people don't seem to care very much for.
If you like modern architecture, of course. And that's another story
isn't it?
I guess it depends on your taste on the eye of the beholder. The tower that didn't get built looks something like Midtown Plaza, but without the aluminum gold cladding on the upper stories and with some texturing. It looks like kind of a cross between the Marine Midland Building and Midtown Tower at about the same height. If it had gone into the skyline, what kind of an effect would it have had on our skyline and the look of our city? If it's built, if it's there straddling Exchange Street today instead of just leaving a couple of stubs for elevators right toward the front of the plaza fronting the street.
Right. I think that, you know, maybe a good amount of the population still might not love the Civic Center or appreciate it, but I think it would have been a complete project. That the tower was meant to be the most distinguished building in terms of size and detailing, and the plaza, all the other buildings, the Hall of Justice, the jail, public safety, were all really supposed to be just secondary buildings around the plaza that kind of deferred to the tower, and then the tower didn't get built. There was supposed to be an observation area on the top there. They did, like you said, there was a lot more detailing to the tower than the rest of the buildings, but it stays within that context of square windows kind of punched into a limestone facade. But it would have been more distinct. It would have been monumental. And like I said, the promenade would have extended to the river, and that whole area would have developed in a different way than it did, you know, with Cornhill Landing and things like that.
Whose idea was it, by the way, to keep the whole plaza paved rather than grassing it in like plazas and public areas normally are?
Well, there were, I think, about five local firms involved, and also the firm that included Ralph Walker, who was the architect of the Times Square building, the Genesee Valley Trust building across the street there. They all had different sections. I believe one of the local architects had the plaza area. I don't know how they came to the decision just to pave it, but I think they thought that there was going to be a lot of activities on the plaza they needed all the space for, you know, the paved space to set up maybe, tables and things.
They have one or two weekend festivals a year there. They usually do the Puerto Rican Festival headquartered in that plaza and a couple of other things, but with the exception of those one or two annual events, not much goes on there. It's not a place where people want to be. Was that an idea that kind of misfired?
Well, yeah, that and Genesee Crossroads Plaza is another example. I get a chuckle. You know, both of those were built on what's called underground parking, except for the fact that they're one story high. So these plazas aren't at street level for most of their run. Genesee Crossroads, you actually have to go down below street level from Main Street to get to it. But once you get to Andrews, you have to go downstairs to get to Andrews. And the Civic Center is the same thing. They call it Underground Garage. Some of it is, but there's a whole story above. Access is harder to get to. These days, it's worse than it's ever been. And it's just a large plaza that I think was built for the idea that the city would expand to 500,000 or even a million eventually, and that plaza would be needed. Whereas with 200,000 today and all the other large plazas we have, they can't all get used, or yeah. You know, or you can't. The Genesee Crossroads gets used for Taste of Rochester, and there's a nice crowd. And I think there was a protest there recently, or it had a decent crowd. But otherwise, you walk there on a weekday, and it's empty. You know, they just not as inviting as Aqueduct Park right across the street, which is a small little grassy area that's street level, and people love that park. You know, it's successful, where the other two aren't.
Is the moral of the story, if you want to bring people in, put some grass and trees in and make it look kind of comfy?
That doesn't hurt, but at Genesee Crossroads, there's plenty of grass and trees. It's just, like I said, that above-ground situation. I think the most important thing is to have the access be at street level or really close to it, so it doesn't seem like it's separate from the fabric of the city. And that's where those two plazas, they fail that way.
In other words, they goofed.
Well, there was a lot of theory, a lot of planning, a lot of, you know, a lot of smart people that knew a lot of things, and a lot of money being thrown around, and, you know, that's what they came up with. Today, they most likely wouldn't do the same thing, but back in that modern era, there was a lot of philosophy driving the architecture, and sometimes not reality.
We'll talk more about that, what might have been and what turned out to be, and whether or not we're better off for it in just a moment. Daniel Palmer, the author of Rochester's Downtown Architecture, with us. Your thoughts very much invited. 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're back in a minute. I'm 1370 Connection from WXXI.
This is Kurt Smith for Perspectives. This week, two historians detail two liberal masters of language. William Luckenberg and how Franklin Roosevelt used English to move a world. David Greenberg and how Adlai Stevenson matched FDR's rhetoric, but not power at the polls. Join us Saturday afternoon at 2 and Tuesday night at 9 on AM 1370 and FM 91.5 HD2.
Thirteen Seventy Connection continues on WXXI. I'm Bob Smith. We are talking with Daniel Palmer, author of Rochester's Downtown Architecture, talking about the ideas that came to pass and some of them that didn't in the years since World War II, how Rochester has changed, how it might have been changed even further if the projects that were on the drawing board and announced had ever come to pass. 263-WXXI, 263-9994, or write to us, asktalk@WXXI.org is our in-studio email address. I'm Bob Smith, and we have this from Will in Rochester, and he's thinking seriously about entertainment venues downtown. What happened to the old theaters, which went the way of course, a lot of things, the interest of urban renewal, and what may be coming. And he's saying, given Rochester's national position in the film industry, why don't we have a cinema capable of showing new technology movies? Why hasn't it been part of the discussion to build a new performing arts facility downtown instead of just a Broadway theater, which we're talking about today? Whatever happened to the idea of a lot of big screen film venues of the kind that used to be there back in the day when we had the Lowe's and the RKO Palace, the RKO Temple, and the Paramount?
Well, save the Eastman Theater, which is, you know, the community gem, and it was built to be a movie palace, but really hasn't been treated that way.
Which was totally reconstructed, reconfigured. It is now a purpose-built music hall.
Right, so that's not even a movie theater anymore. You know, in the example of Lowe's, well, that's where the Xerox Tower is. I would guess if you look around, pretty much all of those old theaters are replaced by a parking garage or a modern building or a parking lot, which is the big tragedy for downtown, is really the parking lot more than what they built.
Right. I mean, nobody's going to kick Ursula Burns out of her office, that's for sure. But by the same token, it is interesting to note that the RKO Palace Theater, which I remember on Clinton Avenue, I don't think there's anything ever been built there. I think that still is a parking lot all these years later, isn't it?
I'm not exactly sure where I was on Clint. I thought it was where the Sister Cities garage is now, or the garage that's behind the Sibley building. But there are a lot of parking lots back in that area on Clinton, so it could either be a parking garage or a parking lot was, I think, the two options it was going to turn out to be.
And a parking garage took the Paramount Theater out downtown? And we know what happened to Lowe's, as you mentioned. Now a whole lot of Xerox workers are working where the movies used to show. So between those three, poof, gone.
In the name of progress.
Did we goof by not leaving at least one of them there, if not more? Maybe it would be a multi-screen multiplex. Who knows what it would be. Maybe it would be the venue where everybody goes to see 3D like Avatar. But did we miss something by taking that out?
Well, definitely. If you ever go to Syracuse and you go to the Landmark Theater, you can see what used to be here. I mean, in different forms, but that extremely ornamental, exotic-looking, lavish lobbies, balconied interiors. The auditorium is a less fancy version, I guess you'd say, of the old movie palaces we used to have downtown. The irony with a lot of these projects is they propose to bring retail, to bring theaters, to bring restaurants, but what they ended up doing in a lot of cases is removing those things and then not necessarily building new ones where they, you know, in their place. And we see it on a smaller scale now with Midtown Plaza, where it was the only centralized area of retail, and once they closed it for redevelopment that we hope will better downtown, but, you know, that remains to be seen. In the meantime, those merchants that were there are now scattered or gone, and there is almost no retail downtown at all. What was left wasn't much, but now it's just almost like they finished the job off.
It's interesting you mentioned Midtown, because that is something that a lot of people look back on with great nostalgia, because they remember what it was in the 60s when everybody came downtown, everybody enjoyed it. It was something special. It was something kind of unique. And it got imitated in a lot of cities. Mead Place Mall in Buffalo comes to mind immediately. And it was a hit for a while. It succeeded for about 20 years there and then ran out of gas. We can talk endlessly about why it ran out of gas. But when it was built in 62, and we tend to forget about this, that was really something huge, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was the first large private development, so to speak. I mean, there was, you know, obviously some city involvement with the financing, but, you know, downtown, we're in the 60s now, so the afterglow of, the baby boom, the coming home, working, you know, getting the factory job was starting to wear off. People were starting to leave the city. There was, we're starting to enter the era of the race riots and a lot of unrest in our cities. And Midtown Plaza was, you know, the Foremans and the McCurdy families attempt to, you know, buy some more time. And, yeah, 20 years is pretty good, actually. Some of the other cities don't like to bring up Syracuse again because I love my hometown. But, yeah, I grew up in downtown. We built the Galleries of Syracuse in the 1980s, and it was way too late by then. It was basically Midtown Plaza type. So Midtown did do its job for 20 years. And, even up until the couple years ago when they closed it down, people still at least used it as a pedestrian way. There was food, the food court was there, and there was small shops for office workers.
I remember how jam-packed it would be. Deep in the 70s and even into the 80s, during holiday shopping season, people went there. But did we kind of reach a tipping point somewhere during the later 60s or the 70s when half the population of the county and of the metro area started living outside the city and commuting into work?
Oh, sure. I mean, the McCurdy family resisted building suburban stores for a little while, but that's where the houses were being built. That's where the people were going, and the highways were built to take them out there. And why would you want to drive 20 minutes to downtown to shop at McCurdy's when you can drive 5 minutes and shop at McCurdy's at Marketplace or, you know, wherever they opened them up at the time? So it was, I mean, it made sense. They went where the people went. Unfortunately, the people went from downtown and the center city out into the suburbs, and so that's where the stores followed.
In a way, did Midtown Plaza stave off some of that, or did it just miss a trend that was already accelerating at such a fast pace that it was inevitable and there was nothing they could do about it?
I think, like I said before, that it definitely did hold it off. I mean, we had a Wegmans down here until the 90s. You know, we had a grocery store. We had, you know, at least two or three major department stores in Midtown. And most other cities of Rochester size going through the same economic, troubles and population decline, I don't think enjoyed that 20 years of, you know, still vital shopping, even if it was constantly in a decline. But like I said, it's just numbers. If the 300,000 people still lived in Rochester, I'm sure Midtown and McCurdy's would still be open, or what, you know, like there'd be something open there. Midtown would still be going because there'd be the number of people to frequent the place.
263 WXXI, 263-9994, the downtown that was, the downtown that might have been, as opposed to the downtown that is. We can see some of each reflected in some of the plans that were made over time. We're talking about all of this with the help of Daniel Palmer, who's the author of Rochester Downtown Architecture 1950 to 1975, which tells the story. You're invited to be a part of the conversation on the line at 263-WXXI, on the phone, or in the email at asktalk@wxxi.org. And speaking of email, we're going to go next. We have an email right now from, I do believe it is Laura in Rochester, and she says, I am excited to pick up this book. I often drive around downtown, and I'm not sure what buildings I'm looking at or what their history is. I'm wondering if Mr. Palmer has a favorite downtown building or landmark. Well, do you have a kind of a personal favorite here?
Well, in the state of the modern theme, I do. Just to let you know, I grew up loving Art Deco, and not being a fan of the modern architecture. It's not something that's easy to love. But saying that, when I first came to Rochester and my friend drove me up Main Street and I drove by the Lincoln Alliance Building and then the Chase Tower reveals itself behind it, I felt like I was in New York City for a second there, and I've always been fascinated with that building, and I know it's a controversial building for what it replaced and for its scale and things like that, but taken as a piece of modern architecture, I just always get a kick out of it. I never get bored of looking at it.
The one we now know as the Chase Tower.
Right, the Chase Tower.
The big white one.
Right.
That used to be marble clad, is now aluminum clad, and that's a whole other story of poor specification. But that, nevertheless, there it is, and I guess it's chock full right now of people. Bankers, basically, is what it's home to. There was supposed to be, it was designed pretty much as originally conceived, and it was built pretty much with the look it finally was intended to, but there's one thing that's different about the initial plans compared to what we have now. There were supposed to be a bunch of rectangular flanking buildings at each corner of the plot that weren't in the end built. What happened there, I guess, first of all, and second of all, are we better off that, A, they didn't take out the old Lincoln Alliance building in order to build one of them, and, two, they didn't build any of the other three?
Well, I'm definitely glad the Lincoln Alliance building is still there because, like I said, I think it's one of those situations where old and new do actually work together to accentuate the other. I think the Lincoln Alliance building is a more interesting building because it's on that plaza, and it, like I said, it kind of reveals the Chase Tower. Those buildings that you see in the picture in the book, I would think are most likely just speculative buildings. A lot of times in renderings, they'll add other buildings to kind of, you know, make it look more impressive. Also, it was originally called the Clinton Square Project, the whole block project, not just the Chase Tower, but also the area behind it that the building called Clinton Square currently sits on. So there was plans for other buildings. They just weren't definite. The funding wasn't there. So in a lot of ways, Clinton Square, the building, completed the Clinton Square project. But those buildings were just there to just, I think, make it look kind of like Rockefeller Center or something, to just kind of impress people, to, you know, make the centerpiece of the Chase Tower with its swooping lines that much more impressive.
Are we better off without them?
We would have a lot more, 40-year-old office space in our city center. So I guess from an economic standpoint, no. But, you know, it's, who knows, maybe the demand a lot of times just with traffic. You build, they say you build a highway and the traffic gets, you know, fills the highway. So maybe it would have been the same with the towers, but I don't think so.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. And we have right now Doug on the line from Fairport. Hi, Doug. You're on the air. Go ahead, Doug.
Well,
yes, sir.
I haven't listened to the whole show. I apologize, but I'm curious to have your guests comment on exactly what is the right formula to revitalize downtown. I don't believe it will ever be comprised of bringing back mass retail in areas like the, you know, the Macy's and the old McCurdy's and Sibley's and so on, because the malls still exist and they are so convenient. And the competition for restaurants out here is huge, and there's very little going on in the city. But it seems to me if we're ever going to bring people back to live there and revitalize it, we need a pretty good state-of-the-art, well-connected transportation center. You need good restaurants, and you need grocery stores. And the big point I want to make is now being disabled and getting elderly, you need very good retirement living, which there's almost none of in the city. I'll listen off the air, but I appreciate your comments.
Thanks very much.
Well, I think that, you know, what we could learn from this book is that these large-scale, you know, well thought out, but not necessarily good for the community plans don't work in the end. And it seems to be that the future of downtown, from what I've heard from meetings and talking to people like Heidi Zimmermeyer, is that, you know, getting the residential area to 5,000 people will start to bring in those services that will hopefully draw in more people, that will hopefully draw in more services. I think that's the only way that downtown could really experience the renaissance that it needs to experience. I think building large-scale projects and hoping that that'll draw more people downtown hasn't really worked in the past and probably won't work that great in the future. I think the focus, I guess, needs to shift to residential, and then the services will follow, and it'll be a snowball effect. We're almost there from what I've been told, and hopefully, you know, within the next 10 years or so, we'll get there and see some things open up.
Will in Rochester says hello to us and says that one of the projects being discussed today that reinterprets in a contemporary way reflecting our history is the Canal District vision bounded by Exchange Boulevard, the Erie Canal Expressway, I-490, West Main Street, and North Plymouth Avenue, and bisected by Broad Street, the original route of the Erie Canal. That project envisions a mixed-use urban neighborhood with maybe 400 or 500 residences, 1,000 people or more working, living, and playing. Is that, in a sense, a better way to go contemporary with our needs now than what we've had on the drawing board in the past?
Well, the whole canal project is another controversial one. You know, it's another situation where people aren't sure if it's a good idea to spend money on a water feature when we have so many other economic problems. I have my own personal feelings on the project and where it might go. But I think really, you know, what they should just focus on is to continue to make good, you know, good solid living spaces downtown and with various income, you know, various levels of you know, rent, so that, you know, you have a nice mixture of folks down there and, you know, get a couple of small stores open up, grocery stores, nothing like a Wegmans necessarily. And then, you know, once you have the people living down there, I think that's when you want to start putting in these features to draw even more people down. But at the same time, I'm not a planner or an architect or any of that stuff. I'm just, you know, a person with an opinion and some knowledge. So, you know, the people running those things probably know better than I do.
There were several different proposals for high-rise apartments of various kinds in the Genesee Crossroads area and in the west side of downtown, none of which were built. I mean, eventually we did get those Plaza apartments on St. Paul Street, which were kind of a fraction of what I guess was envisioned generally with all the different projects. If we'd built all of those things, all these high-rises, and brought more people into downtown, whether they're seniors, a mixture of seniors and working adults, or what have you, Would we have a more vibrant city and a more heavily populated city now?
If those buildings were apartment buildings and continued to be today, I mean, by definition, sure, there'd be more people living downtown. From the plans I saw, though, at least the 1962 plan for Genesee Crossroads, it included 5 apartment buildings. But they were a lot smaller in scale than the Plaza, or Andrews Terrace, as it's called now. And I don't have the figures in front of me, but I would guess that if you looked at the amount of units they planned on having, the Plaza most likely provided the bulk of them, because it is such a large building. It's actually 2 buildings connected, and they're both very large buildings, you know, in and of themselves. So a lot of these buildings that I see in the plans were smaller footprints, much shorter, and I think that there'd probably be some more people here. But, you know, if those apartments were still filled, then sure, there would be more people downtown just by nature, and would most likely, you know, contribute to retail and to grocery stores, things like that.
But bottom line is, we might be somewhat more populated, and now here we are trying to do it again, sort of infill here and there with projects scattered all over the downtown area. Is it any better or worse to do infill of residential here, residential there, than to have big projects concentrating things, including presumably retail and services, close to where large congregations of people are?
Well, one of the you know, wonderful things about downtown Rochester is that we do have a pretty good stock of those, you know, 1800s era buildings that were warehouses, factories, things. They're not being used as that anymore, and they're being converted into apartments. And there are a lot of parking lots near these buildings, especially if you go over the northeast side of downtown. Once you get past St. Paul Quarter area, it starts to get pretty sparse there. But there is a lot of activity going on over there. You've seen windows put into buildings. You can tell that these buildings are being renovated, and, you know, chances are they're going to be residential. If the demand is there, then those parking lots at some point could become, you know, some new residential development or services, and time will tell.
263 WXXI, 263-9994. We have Bob on the line. Hello, Bob. You're on the air with us.
Oh, thank you, Bob. Two things. A backward look. I know Portland, Oregon is bigger than Rochester, but I was out there in the 1980s. And at that time, they only had 2 shopping malls, east and west of the city. And the merchants downtown got together and gave the city money. And if Monday to Friday, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., you could come in, park in a parking garage. And as one transit fellow told me, you could buy a 10-cent candy bar, and the store would stamp your parking ticket, and you could park for free. Now, that to me is one of the problems we have here. You have all these parking garages, but you have to pay so big prices for everything. The other thing is, I lived in Chicago and in Silver Spring, Maryland, and been around the country. I don't see the cooperation in Wren Square as an example. We don't seem to be able to get the cooperation of the city, the county, the businesses, the educational institution, the churches, and the people to do anything. You've seen it. When Wren Square gets started, and then there's a whole bunch of people who are against it. I don't know what the thing is. Now, in Chicago, the city was Democratic and the county was Republican, and they still work together for the good of both things. There's a county tower and a county courthouse right in the heart of Chicago.
Well, I mean,
and it's filled with Republican judges, but the city is Democratic.
Well, Chicago, of course, had a very strong mayor in the dailies, the two dailies.
Right.
And in Rochester, from what I've read and looked into, you know, who was running the city, how powerful the mayor was. There was a city manager, I believe.
Yeah, we didn't have a really powerful mayor with a lot of institutional clout until 1985.
Yeah, so there's a lot of cooks, you know, in the stew in Rochester, and really the size of these projects meant so much more to the city, the size of Rochester, than maybe in Chicago, where it's such a large city that it can absorb it.
Here,
that there was a lot of fighting.
The companies like Bausch and Lomb and Xerox and Kodak, we can't get them to everybody to work together. I think this Wren Square, that might have something like that. But now, as you say, we got the Broadway Theater League wants to come in. And you've got a good point. We could use probably, Isn't there out in Gates somewhere, there's a big theater there for 3D and all that? Well, how come they couldn't build that downtown? Anyway, those are my comments.
Okay, well, thanks very much for offering them at 263-WXXI. We have Chris on the line right now, too. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Yes, hello, Bob, and hello, Mr. Palmer. I tuned in a little bit late, but I believe I heard Mr. Palmer mentioned that he grew up in Syracuse. I like Syracuse. I think it's a very interesting city, especially with the development of Armory Square adjacent to downtown. It's a wonderful place to meet friends and have a beer, have a meal. It's very,
oh, yeah,
I guess
it's,
great. It's a miniature Greenwich Village, if you will.
Yeah.
One of the things I also noticed about Syracuse, downtown Syracuse, when I've been there, is that there seems to be a significantly greater retail, a greater number of retail businesses downtown than in Rochester. I would use it, Salina Street as an example. And I know Syracuse has struggled with the same flight of businesses from downtown that Rochester has, but there still seems to be a very qualitative difference between the two cities, and that Syracuse just feels like it has more retail. And I can't point to any particular stores, but is my observation accurate, and if so, what would account for that difference?
Well, on Salina Street, you will see more retail. I think getting back to Midtown Plaza, I think that might have been one of the drawbacks we're seeing now with Midtown Plaza, is that there wasn't really a Midtown Plaza in Syracuse that had the bulk of the remaining retail concentrated in it and then was closed. Salina Street had its department stores, and like I said, the galleries we built in the 80s, but that never really filled. So the retail that's along Salina Street, you know, if it could survive, it stayed there. And Armory Square, you know, we don't have an Armory Square. I love both cities for much different reasons, and that's one thing Syracuse definitely has on Rochester in terms of downtown, is that it has one distinct district of entertainment, restaurants, and, you know, apartments. The Science Museum is right there. At the same time, if you walk a few blocks past Salina in the opposite direction of Armory Square, you're running into Ghost Town because there's nothing going on over there. It's kind of like the north side of downtown here. The problem with Rochester is everything's scattered. We have St. Paul Quarter. We have East End, you know, the area over by the Blue Cross or Cornhill, High Falls, which, you know, is always in a state of flux. But none of these they're not physically connected, and therefore you have a lot of nice choices, but you don't have one area that really knocks you off your feet when you see it, like you do in Armory Square.
All right, well, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for calling in at 263-WXXI. We have this from Michael in Rochester, who says, I moved to Rochester about 5 years ago from state right outside New York to attend college at RIT, and I've stayed here to work. I have grown to love this city. I enjoy living here. I live off University Avenue, about 10-minute walk from downtown. I find the inner loop is kind of a barrier to get to downtown. It sort of deters you, in a way, from making that walk all the way downtown. It's interesting. We're the only city that I know of in upstate that has that ring road right around the Central Business District. They keep talking about taking it out, except for that part that carries 490 through town, which they really can't. Mm-hmm. But they keep talking about taking the northern two-thirds of that arc out. Would that change the whole complexion of the city if we did that? I mean, keeping in mind that at the end of World War II, it wasn't there. 10 years later, it is. Can we say that that really changed things in a lot of ways and sort of cut off downtown from the neighborhoods around it?
Oh, certainly. I mean, the inner loop's probably the most controversial of all the projects. And I mentioned in the book, it's not architectural, but physical. Boy, the effect it has. It's like a cross Bronx Expressway, a trench dug around downtown. If they filled it in, you know, it goes back to the planners. How are the street, is the street grid going to be reintegrated? Is, you know, Charlotte Street going to connect again? If those things happen and they infill with housing and good-sized structures, I think it would be a great benefit to the city.
Could be interesting to see what happens. Obviously, this is a story that's far from being finished at this point. But thanks very much for telling an important part of it, maybe a crucial part of it, at least as it stands now. My thanks to Daniel Palmer, who is the author of Rochester's Downtown Architecture, 1950 to 1975. He chairs the Landmark Society's Committee on the resources of the recent past. And he's sharing his knowledge with us in this Hour 1370 Connection. Daniel, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Bob. My pleasure.
And thank you all for being with us in this Hour 1370 Connection here on WXXI AM and FM HD2 Rochester. I'm Bob Smith. Stay with us. More to come after the news. We'll see you then.